Hi, I'm Guy Powell, and welcome to the next episode of The Backstory on the Shroud of Turin. If you haven't already done so, please visit guypowell.com and sign up for more episodes. Today, we're talking with Mark Guskin. He is a Shroud and Sudarium researcher. I am the author of the upcoming book, The Only Witness, A History of the Shroud of Turin. It's a historical fiction tracing a possible yet plausible history of the Shroud over the last two millennia. So with that, let me introduce Mark. Mark Guskin obtained a first-class honors degree in Latin and Greek from the University of Manchester at the age of 19, and a PhD in history from the universities of London and Oviedo, Spain. He is the author of various books of popular and academic history, including an award-winning biography of Lady Hester Stanhope, which he wrote in Spanish, a biography of Sir John Moore, also in Spanish, and various books on religious history. His publications also include La Piedra del Destino in 2006, A Very Good Sort of Man, a biography of Charles Lewis Marion in 2017, and Las Coruñas del Mundo in 2019, and with Cambridge scholars, The Tradition of the Image of Edessa, and The Murder of Assunta Yong Fang in 2018. He also runs a translation agency in Spain. Recently, he also wrote the book, The History of the Sudarium of Oviedo, How It Came from Jerusalem to Northern Spain in the 7th century AD. Mark, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me. I hope we'll be able to talk about various different aspects of the Shroud and the Sudarium, see how they can possibly fit together, provide joint supporting circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's quite a bit there. But before we do that, tell us what your backstory is on the Shroud of Turin and also how you got involved with the Sudarium of Oviedo.
Yeah, well, it goes back to my days at school in Leeds in the north of England. And I was at a Jesuit school, and one day they decided that they were going to take us to the cinema to see David Rolfe's first documentary, okay, The Silent Witness, back in 1978, it must have been. And what was funny about that, and it actually got in the local newspapers, is that the standard cinemas wouldn't show it because they had all of their timetables booked up and everything. And the only cinema that they could find that would project it for schools and people was, I suppose you could delicately call it an adult cinema, okay, that showed adult films. But as that was late at night, so it got in the newspapers, you know, that schoolboys from a Jesuit school are going to an X-rated cinema on the school's authority. It was quite funny. But, well, they showed us this documentary, The Silent Witness, and it just sort of really got me hooked. You know, I'll be forever in debt to David Rolfe for that. I've met David on numerous occasions. I've worked with him and been in other films that he's made. And it's great. You know, he's the guy that actually introduced me to this subject. And then because of my studies, you know, the degree in Latin and Greek and classics and everything, it just sort of seemed to fit in that the weak area in Shroud studies was, and to an extent still is, the history of the cloth. And then when I emigrated to Spain, I found out about the Sudarium and how it's like a complementary, I hesitate to use the word relic because that is like automatically saying it's authentic. It's, but I'll use the word just because it's the easiest word to use. And again, the history there, you've got this great limitation. There's not that many people today who are fluent in Latin and Greek under a certain age because, you know, not that many people study it anymore. And It was just an outstanding in the way of pending, in the meaning of pending. It was a subject that hadn't really been looked at. And I thought, okay, I can do this. My speciality is working in archives, finding manuscripts. You sort of develop, like in any profession, experience teaches you, and you know where to look, you know what you're looking for. And I just love working in archives and digging up manuscripts, especially when people tell me I won't find anything. Somebody tells me, you know, no, there's nothing here, you're not going to find anything. Then that's the best way of making me stay there for a few weeks. Okay. And because I'll say, yes, there is. There's always something. It's never all done. People do tend to get that impression as well. Now that so many thousands of manuscripts are digitized, people get this idea that everything is online. And that's just not true. There's still hundreds of thousands of manuscripts that people haven't looked at in hundreds of years. There's an awful lot of work involved in that, most of which never sees the light of day because you don't find anything. What does get published and what does see the light of day is when you actually find something. But nobody is particularly interested in the days and weeks that you can spend plowing through piles of manuscripts and you don't get anything. But that's what it involves. But I love it. I'm very happy doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine the dust and the white gloves and the, you know, and being involved in that. That must be a lot of fun. And I think you're right. You know, the challenge of when somebody says, Guy, you can't do that, or Mark, you can't do that, then all the more to prove them wrong.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, saying, right, you know, you shouldn't have said that. there was one, actually, one of the best experiences I've had in an archive was on in a monastery in Mount Athos on Greece. Mount Athos is a peninsula. I don't know if everybody's aware of this, where the only thing that's on this peninsula is Orthodox monasteries. Okay, mainly Greek, but also Serbian, Russian, Romanian, from the different Orthodox countries. Their strong point is they have 25% of Greek manuscripts that exist in all the world. They hold them. Some of them are more recent, so it's 25% in number, not particularly in importance. It's a very difficult place to get to. No women are allowed, and that is held by European Union law, strangely enough. There was some loophole where they managed to do that. No women can go. You need a special permit to go. You can't just go as a tourist or something. Well, and anyway, I was working there once in one of the libraries. And in this particular monastery, they didn't have electricity. So I was literally working in the library with an oil lamp. And that it was just fantastic. It was, you know, back to medieval times. Other monasteries there have solar panels. Each monastery chooses what it wants to do. And that's when I was doing research on the image of Edessa. And there are lots of manuscripts there that I needed to see, and I managed to see them all.
Fantastic. You know, it's funny because I'm writing as well a book on the sidarium. And one of the things I have is a story on how the actual scripts or the Bible or whatever it happens to be get copied. And at that time, there was no electric light. And if you had a dark day or whatever, if you're trying to work inside a building in the middle of winter and you can't have the windows open because it's just too cold, you've got an oil lamp or a bunch of candles. And I could definitely see where the scribes are sitting there, you know, freezing and also, you know, working against dim light, trying to copy a manuscript across. So I absolutely imagine what you were doing there.
Yeah. And what we actually did then, what the monks let me do in the end, was because I was there in the summer, they let me take the manuscripts out into the courtyard and take photographs. But that's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand. You know, now that you're talking about Bible manuscripts, they're copied by humans, and it's very difficult. Copying is a very tiring business. You know, if you have to literally just be looking at one text, copying it into another, after a few hours, you're, well, or even after a couple of hours, your mind starts wandering. And that's just human. And people make mistakes. And also in the ancient world, when there was no such thing as copyright, copyists would quite happily add to manuscripts. They would quite happily delete passages that they didn't necessarily agree with. And that's part of the fun. I mean, I call it fun because for me it's great fun of trying to establish what the original text was.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And sorry, we're getting a little bit off, but I do a lot of work with the Museum of the Bible, and they have a copy of what's called the Wicked Bible. And not only do you have the problem of the copyist, but you also have the scribe or the apprentice, the printer's apprentice, making mistakes on purpose just to see if they get caught. And so the Wicked Bible is one where you have all the commandments. And the one commandment, of course, thou shalt not commit adultery. This particular apprentice left off the word not. And so thou shalt commit adultery.
To see if he gets caught.
Exactly.
And you know what's funny about that is that that continues into the modern day and age. I have a great many different versions of both the full Bible and the New Testament to compare translations. And my copy of the, I sometimes take this with me to show people, my copy of the Good News Bible, if you are reading the Old Testament, in the middle of the book of Deuteronomy, it suddenly, and this is a printed book, must be maybe 30 years old, you know, it's late 20th century. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the book of Deuteronomy, it suddenly jumps to the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, it's a printing mistake rather than a copyist's mistake. Mm-hmm. And you've got 20 or 30 pages of the Gospel of Matthew, and then it takes you back to the Old Testament. So my point with that is that even if you believe that, you know, the Bible is the divine word of God, there are still mistakes in it. And those mistakes can be made by printers today, or by copyists, but by printers today. And I've got a physical example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happens all the time with anything that gets printed, but certainly, you know, whether you have coins, there's mistakes on coins and things, but, I find that, just fascinating. And, you know, and I have to do one thing, and that is to use palimpsest in a sentence. And so,
it's a great word. It's a great word. And if people don't know what it is, they sort of look at you and think, what's that? You know, it's a really good word.
Yeah. It is awesome. So as I've been studying, you know, the Shroud of Turin, and then of course the, you know, the Sidarium and stuff like that. And I actually just recently, a palimpsest was found. Where there was a Bible, the Bible was written on it, but underneath that was the erased words from, it was on the Star Constellations, one of the oldest manuscripts on the, I think it was Hierapolis, and then that had been erased.
And with ultraviolet and infrared light, you can actually read what's been erased.
Yeah. So anyway, we're getting way off.
It's equal. Well, this is like it's like computer experts. If we think we've deleted a file from our laptop or desktop or whatever, an expert somewhere is going to be able to get in there and find it, and it's not quite deleted as we thought it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And then
it's a palimpsest.
Exactly. So those palimpsests, it's a digital palimpsest then, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. that's what it is.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on a little bit. So tell us about the Sidarium of Oviedo and how it fits in with the Shroud of Turin.
Well, the Sidarium, can I share here? Can I just share an image of it?
Absolutely.
Right. Just give me a minute while I share this.
Okay.
I'm not.
Do you see the share button there?
Yeah. Here we go. Okay, just by way of introduction, that is the cathedral in the town or the city of Oviedo in the north of Spain. Okay, and can you see that, the cloth?
Yep,
Okay,
absolutely.
that is the Sudarium of Oviedo. As people say, you look at it, there's no image on it, it's all creased, it's all been rolled up, screwed up. It's just a dirty old cloth with some stains on it. You don't actually get inspired at all by seeing that. You know, on the shroud, you've got this image of a crucified man, and no matter when it comes from, that image is mysterious and unexplained, and nobody's been able to replicate it, no matter what they claim they haven't. But you look at this, and it's just nothing. Where this cloth gets interesting is when you start to analyze the stains on it, okay, which are, well, the main stains. Can you, if I use the cursor, can you see it?
Yep,
Can you see that moving?
absolutely.
Right.
Yep, absolutely.
These main stains here are made up of one part human blood and six parts pleural edema fluid, which is a liquid that collects in the lungs when somebody dies of asphyxiation. Okay, the stains have been reproduced in a laboratory, and these stains over here on the left of the image, for example, another thing, sorry, let me just go back to the main stains here, is that they are, it's post-mortem blood. Don't ask me how, because I'm not a doctor, I'm a historian, but a forensic doctor, they can tell if they have a blood sample, if it's post-mortem blood or blood shed while the body was still alive. Okay, don't ask me how, because I don't know how. Okay, this blood here is post-mortem blood. In other words, it's blood that came out through the nose and mouth of a bearded man, whereas this blood here, these blood stains here, are lifeblood that was shed in life. So forensic doctors in Spain went into the laboratory to try and recreate exactly how these blood stains were made. You can also see that there's very clear outlines of stains, one on top of the other, which means that the lower stain must have dried before the next stain was made. Okay, so there's a time difference here that we're playing with. And what they did was they, with a model head and exactly the same fluid, I'm not going to go into all the details for the simple reason that I'd be talking here until tomorrow if I did. Well, that's, you know, that was part of the experiment on somebody with the original, with not the original fluid, but the same fluid. This is the one I'm looking for. And they reproduced this with a model head, okay, to get the stains coming out of the nose and mouth. And the conclusions, summarizing, were that these stains were made by a dead male body, male because there was a beard, okay, who also had long hair and who died and was in an upright position with both arms outstretched. Again, I'm just repeating here what the forensic doctors have said. You can ask me anything you want about manuscripts, history, Latin, Greek, and I'll be able to answer it. What I'm doing here is just repeating what the experts have said, because it's something that I really, again, get annoyed about when people start inventing opinions outside their field of knowledge. My field of knowledge is not forensic medicine, but I can understand and repeat what forensic doctors have said. Okay. And the conclusions are that these stains were made by a body that died in an upright position with both arms outstretched and the head leaning to the right and forward. Okay. It was then the next group of stains, the ones that would correspond to the forehead, were made with the body lying on the ground, face down, and with the feet slightly higher than the head. In other words, there was a slope on the ground. Okay. Where the body was laying on the ground with the arms still outstretched, but it had this cloth round the head. Okay. At some point then, after another 45 minutes or 1 hour, the body was picked up. The arms were forcibly moved to the side because there was rigor mortis, obviously. And the body was carried for 5 to 10 minutes face down with somebody holding this cloth against the face. And you can actually see under the microscope the outlines of the fingers that were holding this cloth to the nose and the mouth. The cloth was then taken off the body, off the head, and just, well, we say left to one side because that's what it says. You know, if you read the fourth gospel attributed to John, that's what it says. You know, when the two disciples went running to the tomb Easter morning, they saw somewhere at this point, I think I have this written down. Yeah. Okay. Oh, no, it's in Spanish. Sorry, that I used that for Spain. Okay, well, Simon Peter came to the tomb as well, went inside the tomb, and he saw the linen cloths and the sudarium, which had been over his being Jesus' head, not with the linen cloths, but folded up and left to one side. Now, that coincides exactly with the use of the sudarium. Okay, so you've got that coincidence. It's the same blood group, okay, as the blood on the Shroud of Turin. But as always happens, somebody is going to argue, and skeptics have argued, that any ancient blood sample degenerates into AB, into the AB blood group.
Right.
And again, I don't have the medical knowledge to argue one way or another. I know what I've read. I know what people say. But that's all. If you get to these stains again, the ones that were shed in life, now, because of the way this cloth was wrapped around the head, these stains would correspond to the back of the head, more like, say, the nape of the neck, blood that's in the hair, okay? And those stains are there, and they are also on the shroud. Corresponds to this area on the back image, the dorsal image of the shroud. This, you know, you can see here the back and the shoulders. This corresponds to the back of the head. These blood stains here correspond to the same area on the back of the head. So can you see that? If I move it forward,
yes.
Can you see that with a comparison?
Yes.
The shroud, obviously, is not green, and the sudarium is not bright red like that. That's just for the sake of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The blood stains are dried blood color on both, okay, but for the sake of comparison. Now, if you do an overlay, again, you've got, by turning the sudarium slightly round, you've got this stain here in the middle, whose outline, to my mind, coincides. Now, you've got, you know, as a shroud student, you've obviously heard the name Alan Adler. Mm-hmm. Who left us some years ago. He was a hematologist hematologist out in the States. I don't remember right now. His professional opinion was that there's no way you could deny that these two cloths covered the same body. But at the same time, the skeptic will come and say, well, you know, yes, they might be similar, but it's not good enough to prove anything. And that's, in a way, is the eternal argument with both cloths. You know, a skeptic they do tend to be a bit contradictory because they're very, very strict, a shroud skeptic, about what you can prove if you're trying to argue for authenticity. But anything they say against authenticity, they will say you have to take that like that because that's what it is. Even though if you get 20 skeptics, they've all got different theories and none of them are compatible. So,
I think
do that with just about everything, in especially in ancient history. You can doubt everything. You will not have the kind of proof that we demand today of being able to repeat an experiment in a laboratory. That just doesn't exist from anything in the ancient world. Absolutely nothing.
And I think that's where, you know, in the US and courts, and I would imagine it's also in Europe as well, it's kind of the preponderance of the evidence. Because you have, it may be that somebody might say, well, there's a 90% chance that this overlaps, but then there's a 90% chance that the pollen on the two are the same. There's a 90% chance. And when you add all of that up and you take that as the preponderance of the evidence, then it you can, at least, you know, a reasonable man then would be able to say that, yes, they are overlapping, and yes, they were in contact with the same body at some point, you know, at some point.
And this, to my mind, again, it's going to be a lot of people don't agree with me on this, is where a lot of shroud studies go wrong. They start from the basis that the shroud and or the Sudarium are something along the lines of God's message to us today in the 21st century. And if you believe it's genuine, you have to believe the whole Christian faith in all its details. And I don't buy that. Again, I'm not saying it's wrong to believe that, but I don't think that the shroud shows us that. Okay. Again, it's certainly points in that direction. But from there to saying, you know, okay, you have to go to mass or you have to go to church, whatever denomination. It just, that to my mind is where a lot of shroud studies fall down, and why in the end, most of the debate tends to be between, well, you believe it because you're a Christian and you don't believe it because you're an atheist. And it shouldn't really be like that.
Right.
There is a great amount of science and history that has been shown. And I think that can take us to a certain point. And from that point on, it depends on your personal faith. And you've got this great situation that I love quoting. And anytime anybody talks to me about the shroud, I'm going to always quote this situation because I find it so wonderful. So if you've heard it before, sorry, but you're going to hear it again, which is in the early 20th century, when you have the Jesuit priest Herbert Thurston writing in the Catholic Encyclopedia, debunking the shroud, saying it's, you know, that's something for superstitious people. This is not the modern Catholic faith. We don't think it's true. We don't think it's genuine. It's a fake. And a couple of years later, you have the French scientist Yves Delage, a declared atheist, arguing in the French Academy that the shroud was genuine. arguing from a purely scientific basis and saying, well, if I believe that there was a person called Jesus of Nazareth who existed, what's the problem if there's a cloth that was used to bury his body? Doesn't prove the resurrection, doesn't prove the Christian faith. It's just an object.
Right.
And you've got this wonderful situation of a Jesuit priest saying it's all superstition and a declared atheist saying it's genuine. And I just find that amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So since we've got this, the image of the Sudarium overlaying with the Sudarium and the shroud, how do you believe the body was actually brought from Golgotha to, you know, from the base of the cross over to the tomb. There's a lot of depictions where it's carried in the shroud. The body is carried in the shroud. Do you think that that's the case, or do you have a different...
If we go on the evidence provided by the sudarium, the body must have been carried face down. Obviously, some people either holding the shoulders or the arms, and other people holding the feet, and someone else holding this cloth to the face. Why would they do that? For the simple reason that in Jewish belief, I mean, you still see it, not so much today, because we haven't had a terrorist attack in Jerusalem for a long time, but they believe that the soul is in the blood. You have to bury the blood with the body. So when somebody's been killed by a bomb, they'll go and they'll sort of try and scrape up the bits of blood, and it's a bit gruesome, and the little bits of skin and flesh that get blown all over the place, to bury them with the body so that it's a complete burial. And if there's blood coming out of the nose and mouth, somebody was going to try and absorb it into the cloth rather than just let it fall on the ground. Artistic depictions can be very good as art. They can be a great stimulant to people's faith, but they're not generally historically accurate. I mean, if you just look at most medieval works of art related to any scene in the life of Jesus, you know, people are wearing medieval clothes. There's medieval churches, buildings. It's art. It's not meant to be 100% realistic. You know, Jesus was probably crucified naked, but obviously you're not going to paint that, because to 20th and 21st century mentality, it's just not considered decent or attractive. So they'll cover him, they'll put a loincloth on. Whereas the Roman idea was complete humiliation. Okay. So art always depends on the age when it's produced. And that's fine. Art never tried to deceive people. You know, no artist was trying to say this is exactly how it was. They are trying to provoke an emotional reaction in whoever looked at their work of art. And that's good as well. It's just that it shouldn't be taken as what happened. So I would say that, yes, the body was carried like that to the tomb and then placed in the full-length shroud once it was in the tomb, and this face cloth had been taken off the head. Mm. And as it says in the fourth gospel, left to one side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and to your point as well, you know, even the Da Vinci depiction of the Last Supper, you have a table, and it could be the true.
With a nice tablecloth and everything like that.
Yeah.
But that's how people would have eaten.
Right. It would have been probably a triclinium, and they would have surrounded this three-sided table. Yeah. And so you're so right about the kind of taking what is known and then trying to adjust, maybe not adjust it, but try to evoke an emotion based on the contemporary norms of the time.
Yeah, and what people would understand. I mean, okay, not in that particular painting, but you look at miniatures in manuscripts, and so many times the people are wearing medieval clothes, not what people would have been wearing in first century Palestine.
Right, right.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know, the artist isn't trying to fool anybody. It's just artistic convention. That's all. It's like, I mean, you probably get that. It's like when you write a novel. If you write a novel based on, what's an example that everybody knows? Ben-Hur. Everybody's either read the book or seen the movie. Is the author trying to say that's what happened? No, it's a novel. It's orthodox in its beliefs and comments about Christ, and it's trying to provoke an emotional reaction, which it does.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not an actual event.
Yeah, absolutely. And although it does, and I think that's actually kind of what my book is about, is to be able to learn something about the history and the times and things like that, and yet make it in a way that the story that makes it entertaining and interesting. So so that you actually learn more.
Well, everybody wants to read academic books.
Yeah, exactly. So if you put them into a novel, so to speak, then you can actually get a lot of the points across that you might not otherwise be able to.
Time, you're talking to a human side of people through a novel and through painting and through art.
Right, absolutely.
That's good yeah. as well. You know, I'm not in any way trying to criticize that. I think it's great. As long as you realize, sometimes, I mean, I don't know if you've read The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco.
I have, yes.
Now, in his introduction, he invented this amazing story about how he found this story in a medieval manuscript and everything like that. And so many people believed it. And it's like, well, no, that's just part of the story. He's just having you on. That's just part of the novel. But so many people actually believed that what he said in the introduction was true. And it's funny how that works.
Yep, absolutely. Let's change the direction here a little bit. So how is the history of the sedarium and the history of the shroud, how are they interwoven, using the a cloth term? Yeah. How are they interwoven between each other?
I mean, let's just say first that there's no way around the fact that the history of the shroud is difficult. Again, there's two sides to every story, or 100 sides to every story, as there always is, no? But, for example, here, I'm thinking what a lot of skeptics say, just kind of twisting the information and saying there's no evidence of the shroud before the 14th century. And you're saying, no, that is not actually true. There's plenty of mentions of the burial shroud of Christ before the 14th century. You know, historical documents are not full of them, but there's certainly enough to credit and believe that the burial shroud survived and was kept and was venerated. Okay. The question is that the shroud that today is kept in Turin? Okay. But, you know, again, it's that fine line of saying, oh, well, this shroud appeared in Europe in the 14th century, and before that, there's no evidence for it. That's not true. You know, there's documents mentioning the preservation and keeping of the burial shroud of Christ dating back to the second century. Okay. But having said that, you know, we cannot automatically assume that that's the shroud in Turin. There's a good likelihood of it, but I can understand the arguments against that. There's the theory of the image of Edessa, very attractive, again, but it has its weak points. It's like so many things in ancient medieval history. You know, you can argue that the majority of sources say that the image of Edessa is just an image of the face, and that's absolutely true. The majority of sources do say that. But at the same time, there are some that say it was a full body image with bloodstains on it. Okay. So the argument is not about the majority. Is the majority always right? No. Why would, if the majority of texts and people think that the image of Edessa is just a facial image, why would somebody go and say, well, actually, it was a full body image with bloodstains on it?
Mm.
You can argue from both sides. You know, people will then get really worked up and say, well, you've got these texts saying it was a full body image. There must be some reason why somebody at some point in history thought that the image of Edessa was a full body image. And just because for each one of those texts, there's 100 that say it was only a facial image, doesn't mean that it's necessarily wrong.
Mm.
But it's just another example of how you can argue from both sides. Now, the good thing here about the sudarium, which is what I've tried to show in that book of the of all the different Latin texts is that the Sudarium is very easy for a historian if you know where to look. You know, there's a rule in all history that people apply to. I mean, if you've read John Mayer's books on a marginal Jew, you know, the history of Jesus of Nazareth, he often talks about multiple attestation, which is basically if two witnesses, either people or in our case manuscripts, that are not related to each other, say the same thing, well, the likelihood is that that thing, that event, that saying actually happened. Okay, an example of that could be if Guy Powell broadcasts a video saying that he's seen a group of people, 250 of them, all dressed up as Abraham Lincoln, and they just walked past his house. Well, people might think, well, Guy, maybe you had a, you know, a glass of wine too many at lunch. You know, that sounds a bit weird to me. But then somebody else who doesn't know Guy Powell, has never met you in his life, says the same thing. Ah, on this day, you know, I saw a group of people in this street all dressed as Abraham Lincoln. And if you haven't colluded with that person, well, the likelihood is it's almost impossible for two people who are not working together to invent the same story. So it's likely to be true. Okay. Now that happens with when you try to establish the history of the Sudarium, we can get it back to the 5th century in or near Jerusalem with various different manuscripts from various different parts of the world and that are not copies of each other. And some of the details are slightly different, but the essential elements are the same. Now, if I share again, can you see that, the manuscript there?
Yes, I can.
Right, okay. Now, this is a slide, that's a detail of that I love to use. Well, it's a while since I've been to a Shroud Congress, but when scientists would put up all these complicated equations and say, well, I would put this slide up and say, all right, can you read that? And they would say, well,
not
no,
without difficulty. Right. Well, yeah, right. Yeah,
that's my vengeance. That's my revenge on you. Okay. this is one of the manuscripts that explains the history of the Sudarium. Okay. If we move down, we have, that's the third page and the fourth page. Now here, I know this is maybe asking a bit much, but here, we've got S-U-D-A-R-I-O, and that's the abbreviation of Domini, of the Lord, the Sudarium of the Lord. That's in the list of relics that were moved to Oviedo in the north, okay? Another of the manuscripts, okay? Here we have a detail of it. We can, it's a bit clearer here. You know, the medieval way of writing S-Sudarium.
Yep.
Okay? You can see it there. There are manuscripts from that are kept nowadays in Madrid. Okay, this is one of them with the different pages. This one is in a place in northeast France called Valenciennes. It's probably the oldest manuscript telling the story. Okay, again, we can see Sudario Domini, the Sudarium of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And here, we've got the route that it took from the city of Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Okay, it was taken to Africa, from Africa to Carthage. Carthage, not the Carthage in North Africa, but New Carthage in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Carthage to Toledo, which was the capital of the Visigothic kingdom in Spain. And from Toledo to Asturias, to the Church of the Holy Savior, in the town called Oviedo. Okay, so we have all of these different manuscripts, you know, like I say, different times, different places. This one is kept in Brussels. Okay, and they all agree on this history that the Sudarium was kept in Jerusalem until the early 7th century, the year 614, when the Persians invaded Jerusalem and the Christians fled with everything they had, relics, clothes, books, whatever. Okay. And they found their way to Spain. The Sudarium was in Spain, came into Spain before 621 because of the name of the king under who it was taken to Spain. Okay. And it was taken when the Moors invaded Spain in 711. Again, the Christians fled northwards to Asturias. Asturias is the region in Spain where the city of Oviedo is. Okay. And they took it there, and it's been there ever since. Now, that is the kind of history that it's very difficult to argue against. You've got multiple sources all telling you the same thing. And even if you admit that, you know, you're not having to admit that the Catholic Church is right about everything. It's just saying that these people with their relics, with their cloths, took the cloth from Jerusalem, across the north of Africa, into Spain, and they took it up there. You know, I don't see what the problem is with admitting that. But again, a skeptic, they tend to get very scared of admitting anything because it might say, wow, you know, I can't say that there might be a God. but this is not saying that. This is just saying what happened to a certain object. Then there's another document, which is a kind of diary of a pilgrimage. Okay, pilgrims throughout the ages have kept diaries and noted down the places that they saw, what they saw there, why they went there. Pilgrims to the Holy Land, you know. Oh, we went to Bethlehem, we saw where Christ was born, even though he wasn't born in Bethlehem, but well, that's another story. You know, we went to Golgotha, we saw, we walked up the, you know, the way that he went with the cross. And there's one, it's an anonymous account, even though it's attributed to a certain Saint Anthony, but it's actually anonymous, saying that in a monastery by the River Jordan was where they kept the Sudarium. Okay. And that's dated to around the year 570. Okay. So we can date the Sudarium back to, without any doubt, back to the late 6th century. Okay, now, if the two cloths covered the same body, we know that, for example, the Shroud of Turin has never been in Spain. Okay, the only place they could have coincided was in, let's say, Palestine, let's not limit it to Jerusalem, sometime before the 6th century. That's as far as history will take us without getting into speculation.
Right.
It fits in. Okay. That's the conclusions that if the two cloths are related to each other, then, you know, historically we can say that the only place and time they could have coincided was Jerusalem or the area around Jerusalem sometime before the 6th century.
Yeah.
Which is not bad, as ancient history goes. You know, it's quite good to be able to say that.
Yeah, well, and plus you made a point before, I think, when you were talking about multiple sources, even of the image of Edessa, where, you know, some say you just saw the face, some say it was the full body, some had there was blood on it. Those differences actually, to me, almost lend more credence to the whole story.
Yeah.
Because they're not telling exactly the same. So if I had seen the 250 Abraham Lincolns walking by and somebody used exactly the same words, then there would be potentially proof of collusion. Yeah. But if they're very, if they're slightly different, then the
somebody else might have said 300 because it's very unlikely that you would stop and count them.
Yep,
and to you, it looked like 250, and to somebody else, it looked like 300. But the essential truth that that happened becomes undeniable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing, and I think, and that variation also depends on kind of what the message is of what the writer is trying to get across. is, you know, so they're going to write something and say, well, yes, without writing it, I knew there was a whole body there, but I wanted to talk about the image because it was the, you know, the face of God. And somebody else might want to say, well, I wanted to prove that it wasn't just a face. I wanted to show that there was actually something else there. So I'm going to talk about the body. So you have then in all these manuscripts and everything that you are able to find on the image of Edessa or in the sudarium or the shroud is you have different things that the writer is trying to get across. And in worst case, some of them was a fraudulent. Some of those are trying to get some kind of a fraud across. And unfortunately, the job of the historian is to somehow make heads or tails of all that.
Yeah, but even if they were wrong, what's absolutely undeniable about that is that at some point in history, somebody, for some reason, thought that the image of Edessa was a full-body image with bloodstains on it.
Mm.
Why would they think that? That's when you can start speculating. Did they see it? Were they trying to prove anything? What advantage could they gain from that? None. Basically, you know, you can understand, for example, going back to the question of copyists and the New Testament. Well, any verse in the New Testament, like the one in the inserted verse about the Trinity, you know, there are three witnesses in heaven and three witnesses on earth. Well, it's an insertion, a later insertion. Mm. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's false. I don't want to offend anybody's beliefs. You can say, well, the copyist would have something to gain. He's trying to prove a point.
Mm.
He's trying to prove an orthodox belief point in that case. Somebody saying that the image of Edessa is a full body image has nothing to gain because that was never church doctrine. So,
well, true. Yeah.
Start to think, well,
yep.
What's his reason for saying that? You know, he's not going to get paid for saying it. He's not going to prove his faith anymore by saying that. But at some point in time, some people did believe that.
Right.
And that goes against the grain of the majority of texts. But again, the majority are not always right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I would love to keep going. I know we've got a whole list of different things that we could talk about. And but maybe before we close, is there one last thing you'd like to get across, and then we'll kind of close out the talk?
Not really. I mean, I think it's difficult to shut me up when I get going, but I think I've sort of covered everything. I would like to say I think my point of view is quite clear that there is a certain amount of hard science and hard history involved in these studies that some people tend to exaggerate and say, oh, well, you know, this proves the resurrection and all of that. It doesn't. You can't prove the resurrection. You can never repeat it in a laboratory. You can believe it, certainly, but you never prove it to a 21st century scientific mind. You cannot prove against it either. It's just one of those things that is sort of escape science, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, to one other point, and I don't know, it used to be that we didn't have video of crime. Yeah. And we didn't have DNA of possible perpetrators. And so 20, 30, 50 years ago, the way that you could prove something is very different than today. Yeah. And similarly, you know, where today you have the you have DNA and you have quite often video and you can actually see the perpetrator. And as the jurist, you can, as the person on the jury, you can see that. And, but here going back, 2000 years and then looking at all of the different things that are going on, you only have partial proof across each and every one of the different pieces of evidence that you have. And it's, and I think it ends up being the summation of all of that that actually makes the difference as to whether you then can conclude that the shroud is authentic, the sudarium is authentic, and or as opposed to, you know, some other conclusion that you might come across.
And I think as well, a lot of people who haven't studied history in an academic way, tend to think that we should be able to prove everything like we can today, like going online, finding a video, finding an image, and saying, well, you know, it must have been like that because I'm seeing it now. Ancient history doesn't work like that. You're always weighing up possibilities for and against everything. You know, there are people who doubt that, you know, if you start getting to that extent, you know, there are people who doubt that Christ existed, which is just stupid. There's, you know, so much evidence in favor of him existing, much more than for many other figures from the ancient world. And maybe, you know, just by way of summary, what I would like to say is I'll be very happy if one day the whole debate about the shroud and the sudarium can be separated from this sort of dichotomy of believer, non-believer. I understand that for a believer, it's much more interesting because you want to find out about what you're believing in. And you want to know as much as possible.
And for a non-believer, it's also kind of scary because all of a sudden your life beliefs and your whole being is potentially put into question.
I have that impression that that happened. I mentioned earlier John Mayer's book, The Marginal Jew. And I think that when he started, he was a Catholic priest. He died actually very recently, October this year. And he published 5 volumes of this incredibly profound study on the historical Jesus. And I think he surprised himself as to how little we do actually know. Historically, I'm saying. I don't think he really thought, because he was being very serious as a historian. And I think that he surprised himself with that.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Well, with that surprise, thank you so much, Mark, for being on today. Really appreciate it. And I think overall, bringing the shroud and the sudarium together provides another level of proof to the authenticity of the shroud. And certainly the volume of information on the sudarium is also fascinating as it now starts to unfold and the work that you've done and others have done to bring that to light. Otherwise, you can find out more information at markguskin.com. That's markguscin.com, markguskin.com. And he's got all kinds of interesting stuff out there. So, Mark, thank you very much. And otherwise, please stay tuned for other videos in this series of The Backstory on the Shroud of Turin. Please visit guypowell.com and sign up for more episodes. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And I hope to, I'm open to participating in anything you want on any other episode. Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'll take you up on that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.